the gift of witchcraft.
I was able to see, hear, and communicate with spirits.
A very personal relationship between a person and spirit.
Carnal lust and fun things like that.
Working with different energies and spirits and communicating.
Creating magic.
Powerful ritual and powerful spells.
She's actually sticking me in the cauldron.
The role of the witch is to make change.
Bless it be, yo.
Bless it be.
People ask me, like, okay, I'm a witch and I don't know what to do.
20 years ago, three young friends realized they were witches. They scattered to different parts of the world, following magic and spirit. Now, they're back in their hometown to share what they've learned.
Welcome to That Witch Life Podcast, your home for living as a witch in today's world.
Welcome to That Witch Life Podcast. I'm Hillary, I'm your host today. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Kanani and Courtney.
Yes.
Hello.
Today, we have a ton of amazing things to talk about, including having the incredible Tomas Prower on as a guest, who's the author of Morbid Magic, Death, Spirituality, and Culture from Around the World.
Oh, man, this is the perfect time to be talking about stuff like this.
I know.
We're into the death season.
We're into the death season for sure.
Yeah.
And it was actually a really interesting book to read. I think that I come from a family who's very, very open about death. So there were some things that were, felt really common or familiar to me. And then other parts of the world and different cultures and how they, approach death, both pre-death, the dying process, and then the grief process. And I thought it was, such a fascinating journey, and to see that there are actually some similarities and carryover culturally from different regions and different areas, and then some practices that are very, very different. So there's some commonalities, and then there's also some very specific cultural rituals and practices around death. So I'm really excited that I got to read it, and now you guys can fight over it.
And we will, but I don't know, Kanani might be nice to me because I just bought her a dress.
We did. You know, we went to a drag queen brunch. The drag queens were great. The brunch was incredibly underwhelming.
So we ditched it early and went shopping.
You know.
Well, what happened was Kanani came over to my house and she's wearing a t-shirt and blue jeans and these sneakers going to a drag brunch. And I already
and that's
had...
That's just not acceptable.
No, but I already had this dress that I thought she was going to want anyway. And it's super gothy. And I said, look, this is your size. And she's like, oh my God, I want it. So she put it on. And I said, you should wear it to brunch, but I think we need to change your shoes. And she and I wear the same shoes. So we're upstairs and got her these shoes. And then it was, okay, you can't wear it with, you know, your freaking fleece. So I brought out my leopard print coat.
No, Margaret is allowed.
Margaret.
And she's
I named the coat Margaret.
And she says, I'm keeping this. I said, like hell you are, because that cost me $100 at a flea market back when I didn't have $100 for anything. So I didn't eat for several days because I wanted that coat. So no, I earned the coat and you don't get to keep it.
I look damn good.
Yeah. So when we were talking about it, we were like, I think we need to keep shopping and get Kanani back more into her Morticia Adams soccer mom style.
Yes.
You know, more Morticia, less soccer mom. We know that's where you really belong.
I know. It's like, well, we talked a lot about clothing that is like an interest or a basic article. So like a black dress, a black skirt, a top or whatever, but having kind of like a statement pop of color or something like that. So it was really nice to go out there with Kanani and have her try on some really awesome dresses, one of which she's wearing right now.
Yes,
and it looks fabulous.
I'm continuing to wear it because it was so comfortable.
It's like a little sweater dress. It's super cute. It's perfect for this.
The best part was we're pulling into the parking lot in the consignment store when Kanani realizes, oh, wait, I think I left my car unlocked with the key still in it back in the other lot. Should we go back? And Hillary and I said, let's go shopping first. So we go inside, and it was a lightning round. I think
and I'm
like, 20 minutes.
Okay.
We find her two outfits. Boom, she tries them both on. Get to the register, buy her clothes. Her birthday's next week, so I'm like, one of these is on me, so I'm getting one of these for you. And then
I'm like actually choking and laughing right now.
I go back.
It was more important to go to the consignment store for an outfit than it was
sure
to make sure my car didn't get stolen.
Yeah.
That's the reality of
life. We were literally in the parking lot. So it was like, and,
and the best part is it's like 3 minutes away from where the car was. So yeah, it's not like we've driven half an hour.
It's also, I was like, we're in a, it's in a small town. It's not like we're like in the middle of like a, you know, like
oh, downtown people, people break into houses and cars in this, this town too.
But if we were in downtown Portland, we would not have made that decision.
I think it's, you it's about 50-50.
I might not have gone
It's 50-50 here, McMinnville, Portland. Just give, if you're here long enough, you'll know it.
And I mean, when Courtney says she had a dress for me, she didn't have a dress for me. She had a Halloween costume.
That she would wear as a dress.
That I would wear as a dress. And she's like, I have a costume slash outfit for you. And she's like, most people would wear it as a Halloween costume, but you'll wear this all the time. And so, of course, I wore it as a dress. That's...
It is so like us to purchase tickets to something and then blow it off.
Yeah.
You're like, well, it was bad, though.
It was bad.
I mean, like, the food was terrible.
And also, I was like...
They also didn't have forks.
No.
They had sticks.
We're eating with sticks.
Not chopsticks. Not chopstick friends. Like...
Skewers.
A supposed skewer to, you're that supposed, you would do with like
they didn't
cheese,
have
like
a serving. Well, they didn't have serving tongs for the bacon. I mean, it was really weird.
Yeah, so it's like you would. It, yeah, I don't know how to describe it other than like it's like what you would put a tiny piece of cheese cube on, except you were supposed to eat your whole brunch like that. I mean, by brunch, I mean, like, a really shitty pastry, another really shitty pastry.
It's no wonder. The reason they're throwing it is because the tasting room was closing. And yeah. When Kanani was like, oh, I'm sorry they're closing, it's like, well, I'm not surprised because they really suck. That's the reason I don't go there. And when we were there and they would just, like, you had three bartenders standing behind the bar, like, talking to each other and not noticing there's a line of people wanting drinks. I'm like, this is why your business isn't thriving.
Yeah, like, people
this is
not-
it. This right here is why.
This right here. Oh, man.
Who's so we left to go shopping.
Who is excited to read this book?
Yeah, I actually got to flip through it before I gave it over to you, and it's
you
quite
bitch.
Good. I know, I did. Well, it was at my house, so what
That's
do you
true.
Want?
That is true. It was actually really amazing. I've had the real privilege of being able to experience... I went down to Dia de Muertos in Oaxaca City, in Oaxaca... in that region, the celebrations are they're massive. And in Oaxaca City, it was a really incredible experience to see how death, like that ritual around death and remembrance and grief was presented. And it was incredibly moving. To go everywhere you go, there's ancestor altars all over the place. Every business, every house, right? Everywhere I went, there was one. And going to the cemeteries and seeing people, clear the cemetery and the ritual behind caring for that space, then sitting there and leaving food for their loved ones and sitting and eating with them and talking about them. And then as well, in the evening, all the candles being lit and people playing music. And it's just this really beautiful way to talk about people and interact with the dead. And I thought it was so neat. I think that in the book, there's a lot of different cultures that talk about part of their spiritual practice is in caring for the dead and or in making sure that the dead are remembered. So yeah. I have a section of my altar is ancestor related. I'm not like our previous guest, Najah, who has like an altar for everything. I'm super jealous. But I have a section of my altar that's dedicated to ancestors. Do either of you guys have anything like that?
Yeah, I actually, my husband and I finally got our ancestor altar together since we moved a couple of years ago. It's just been this kind of a block in my practice and I'm not sure why. And part of it is where I need to grow spiritually is that I do have such a hard time letting things go. And so,
me too.
Yeah. And so one of the reasons when I finally got our ancestor altar together and I put things up there, I got, you know, I had tears and I realized I still am sad and angry about a number of the deaths of the people that are up there. A lot of the people on my ancestor altar are people I knew in life and they died before their time really. And so there's, I know that this was something, I actually had a dream about this a few months ago, that a couple of friends of mine who passed away when they were, friends of ours, honestly, that passed away when they were 17, 18, came to me and said, you know, it's really time to stop all this. At first I thought that, oh, wow, there's just been too many people haven't really let them go. There haven't been enough rites and rituals. And I realized a lot of it for me was that it was about me not being really angry that these people lost their lives as children, honestly. And that I've gotten the opportunity to do all these wonderful things in my life. And they never got that chance. Like, they didn't even get to go to senior prom or anything.
Yeah.
And so that was something I had to work on is to let that go. But I feel like that's such a gift at this time of year is to, I think it's why it's so perfect that you're bringing this book as this topic for this episode, because we're right at the beginning of October. We're all consciously or unconsciously thinking about death Halloween in the United States can be so bawdy, and it's a lot about sex, and it's a lot about gluttony because there's candy and alcohol.
And a lot about like gore, over the top gore.
Yeah, but the same time, it gives us the opportunity to really embrace that which is pretty taboo.
That's
right?
Very true.
And so death is part of that. And sometimes, like the idea of the sex and the bodiness are often linked together. And this, you know, there's something I was reading about when I was researching Hakate for my new book, is that sometimes she takes on the face of this character whose name I'm forgetting right now, but it will be in my book, so just stay tuned. And then when Demeter was crying because she lost her daughter, this character is flashing her boobs and flashing her genitals in order to make Demeter laugh, right? So there's a sense of death being really over the top and flamboyant and crazy. Like, anybody seen Corpse Bride, right?
Maybe.
Yeah. So it's, you've seen it?
I've seen Corpse Bride.
So what's interesting is that the living are all drab and really gray. And then the dead are all like, party, you know, there was like really influenced by the New Orleans funeral rites. And so, you know, our culture right now, death is, I wouldn't say it's taboo, but it's something that people don't like to talk about.
It's kind of taboo. It's taboo in the sense, it's not taboo as in like shameful taboo, but it's taboo
right.
as in we don't talk about that. And it's the reason we don't talk about it in this culture, I think, is because we're afraid to talk about it. Like, people have this this really weird fear that if they talk about death, they're talking about that they're going
to
die.
Or they're going to invite it to
them. They're going to invite it to themselves. Like, they're going to say, talk about someone having cancer, they're going to get cancer. You know, and it's very weird because, you know, for me, like my family is very open about death. They always have been. So I feel like there are times when I'm very open about it and people are like, what the hell is she talking about?
I think we've also, though, completely removed ourselves from death. Because if you think about it, the second that someone dies, they're taken away somewhere else.
They're
off to a funeral home, or they're in a morgue, or they're somewhere before they get taken to, you know, usually a funeral home and all this stuff. And so literally within moments of passing, they're no longer around. They are taken away. So I feel like in a lot of ways we have separated ourselves from the death process.
Yes. And I think too, I mean, I think that that is very different from other cultures. I mean, I think that, and other magical and spiritual practices.
Yes.
I mean, I think for some people, part of that process is it's so important to the process, both for the person who's passing over, but also to the person that is experiencing the grief, that connection to that whole process is part of, it's magical in of itself. It's hard. It's sad. I mean, it's sad. I mean, grief is brutal, but there is so much, I think, magic and spirituality in the whole process of having that connection with death, whether that be in the dying process or whether that be the way you connect with people after they die.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. In every culture that I have, there's a book that the title and some of the language in this is really colonialistic and I feel very condescending, and it's called primitive mythology. So calling anything primitive really is not okay,
great,
and
not
it's
cool.
Not accurate, because oftentimes the word primitive is something that more colonizing cultures would label indigenous cultures. So I just want to
derogatory.
Thank you, that's the right word.
It's derogatory.
You know, so I just want people to hear that. But what is interesting about this book is not necessarily the author's take on these different religions, but it's the interviews with the different elders that Joseph Campbell, the author, did with these people. And one of the things that I found through his travels throughout the world, whether these were the Inuits up in northern North America or in Mexico or in Mongolia, is that the real magic came from relationship with the ancestors and with the dead. And so witches have always had a deep connection with the dead and with spirits. And I know that for me, a lot of my information comes from the spirit world, usually in dreams. And it's often from people who have passed over because they have more access to knowledge. And so I think that that's one thing that we as witches don't want to forget, is that our connection to the dead, and also how we honor the dead, whether it's through the actual funeral rites, which this book talks about, or it's the rituals we do afterwards, like during this time of year in October, November.
Or the rituals we do in preparation for
death. Yeah, absolutely.
You know? I think that there's a lot of, you know, I think there's a lot of ways to honor the death process, from the kind of start of active dying all the way through to, you know, communicating and continuing to have a relationship with your ancestors, with those that have passed.
It'll be interesting to hear from both of you is what kind of things do you do in order to either prepare for the passing of a loved one, or what do you do immediately after the passing of a loved one in your own magical practice to either help them cross over or to maintain connection? What do you do?
I have had minimal people in my life that have passed. And so I think that the thing that we've talked about before that I've started doing with the kids is we light candles. And we, you know, to help them cross over and to you know, find their way to the light and to help them find peace. And we also try and send energy to bring peace to those around them. Because to me, once they're gone, they've already found peace. Whatever was ailing them or holding them back or causing them pain, they no longer have to suffer through. But now their family is suffering because now their family is grieving. And so really we want to give that positive energy and that healing energy more so to the family and the people that they have left behind. So I do a lot of that kind of stuff. And, you know, I also have talked to people who've passed. I've been visited by my grandfather and he's one of the few people in my life that has passed. And so those are the kinds of things that I do. I've had, I would say, fairly positive experiences with things like that. I've been very blessed that way. I know some other people that have had much more horrific death, traumatic experiences, where the ones to me that are always the worst are the ones that are sudden. You know, no one knew it was coming. You see them one moment and the next moment they're gone, and there was no preparation.
And for the deceased as well. And I think a lot about one thing our culture does in order to recognize a sudden death, or especially of a car accident, are the roadside shrines.
Yeah.
You know, when somebody puts up a cross or a wreath of flowers or something. And there's two things going on there. One, you're acknowledging that there was a death, and so it's a place for the living to grieve, but also for the spirit that passed away, that they know what happened.
Right.
Because if it happened very suddenly, they might not know.
Yeah.
Well, and they might be confused.
Because they're also not at home. They're not in a hospital. Right. They can't, you know, they're...
Yeah, if you're in a hospital or your house, like, you're... It's... you. What you see is
You see clear. Things that happen, but it's all of a sudden, you know, you're on a roadside and your spirit's still there, but then all of a sudden you see that there's a something, that flowers or a cross or... And the name, and then all of a sudden it's, okay, now I know what happened.
Now I know what happened.
And can move on from there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting thing that happened to me recently, and I feel like my rites with those who have passed away have been very unique. And I don't mean like unique to myself. I mean, each one has been unique. And I know that Hillary and I lost a friend about a year ago. Mm-hmm. And I had a dream the night before he died where I was really angry about something and I was screaming. And I talk about this in my Morgan book. Because we had just become friends again, like had healed from some really awful things when he died. And then I dreamt that I was really angry about something, and I woke up and found out he died, and I was really pissed because I was like, damn it, we just became friends again and now he's gone. And I told him, I said, listen, if ever you need my attention, here's a song I want you to play. And it was Madonna's Take a Bow. Because that was the song that I used to like listen to a lot back in high school. And I said, this, you know, this is theater. This will remind me of you and that kind of thing. I don't think he liked it, because the next day I heard that song playing over some mall loudspeaker. People don't play that song anymore.
Yeah. No.
And then I was like, what does he want? And then the next song that came on was Gwen Stefani's I Know We're Cool, which came out about the same time.
Yeah.
Which is about two people that had a falling out and they became friends again. Yes. And I was like, I think what he's saying is, I'm not into the Madonna song, but if you really want me to play a cheesy song from that era,
here it is.
And so, you know, whenever, if I felt like he'd visited, I might play it just to say, hey, I hear you. Or if I heard that song somewhere, I might stop and, you know, check in with his widow, not tell her, oh, I felt like he came to visit me, because that would be upsetting.
Hey,
but
saying,
hey, how are you holding up? Yeah. Checking with his mom. Hey, how's it going?
How's it going?
But then it was really interesting. About a month ago, I dreamt of seeing him again, and I dreamt that he was getting on a boat and leaving, and he's like, hey, just goodbye, take care. And I was like, oh, it's funny. And then I felt like something, there was space there.
Yeah.
Turns out that was the 1-year anniversary of his death. I didn't remember the day he died, because I didn't find out about it, so I didn't actually know exactly what day he died.
Yeah.
Because I found out a few days later, but but that was like on his death anniversary. It's and I haven't felt him around since.
Yeah.
So I felt like that song, using that Gwen Stefani pop culture, you know, reference, was one of my funeral rites for him. It's like, this is how I say, you know, we are good. Everything between us is settled, and I'm happy for you that you've, you know, of where your life ended up. It just sucks that it ended and when it did, you know?
Yeah. For me, it's unique to the individual. So like how I either communicate or honor that person is very different. Sometimes it's with a song. Sometimes it's when that song comes on the radio.
Yeah.
With my mom, I have a candle that I had made by a friend of mine who's a witch for her memorial. So, like, if I want to communicate with her, I usually light that candle. Or if I want to, like, bring her energy in, or, you know, kind of just... it depends. Whether I want to bring her energy into my house or whether I want to speak with her directly, I usually light that. Yeah, I mean, it depends. I usually... sometimes it's specific, and it usually is. I have a number of candles I use for individual people that I don't really light unless I'm communicating with them, or unless I'm trying to do something for all of the, or like call all of their energy in, whether that's protection or whether it's to like honor my ancestors or those that have gone. So for me, part of it too is like learning what that person, how that person would want to be remembered. I mean, sometimes we don't have the luxury of that. Like someone passes suddenly, or we find out about it, suddenly we don't know. I think that I wish culturally we spoke more about that, because it avoids those moments when there is a sudden loss of not knowing how, like what that person might want, not just in their, like whether they want to be cremated or buried or whatever, but in how they might like to be honored. And I, you know, like I have tattoos that honor people.
Yeah.
So it really, I mean, I think that it, part of it, I think, is things that I know someone would really like, you know, whether it be like a song, whether it's lighting a specific candle, whether it's putting an offer on an altar that you know that is something that someone would love or like or loved. But I also think sometimes it's kind of, especially if you don't have the opportunity to communicate with that person either prior or after death. Sometimes it's just, you know, really trying to kind of meditate on or kind of focus on what you think that person, what you think you could do to offer or honor that person. And for me, it's like, sometimes it's just placing something simple on an altar. Like if I knew that someone loved a particular flower, maybe on the day they died, I might, next to their photo on an altar, put that flower there.
And I think that's one thing I think we have to be careful about. I don't feel like the things you all are talking about edge into that territory, but I think that I'll go step back a second. I think that one of the gifts of funeral rites, which is something we'll be talking about with Tomas, is the opportunity to say goodbye and accept that it's over. And I think sometimes either it's because that process really didn't get completed for someone, or the person's having a hard time, like me, letting go. Sometimes the way that we honor our dead keeps them tied to this plane of existence.
Yes.
And that comes when sometimes somebody is like, please come back, I miss you so much.
No, and I think you have to be really careful. And what's really interesting is I also find sometimes that spirits won't visit if they think it's going to be too unsettling.
Yeah.
When my mom first passed, I didn't feel her at all. And I think it was because it was too raw.
And I think there must be something about the spirits that the deceased are not able to get close to their immediate.
It's too,
I just don't think, I think they often tend to visit people on One Ring out.
Yeah.
Like friends.
Yeah.
Or before, extended relatives. Yeah. Because there must be some reason. It might be too difficult for the deceased. Right. And it's certainly too difficult. Or the person may be too consumed too with close. Grief.
You, and you can't.
You can't get there.
You can't. I mean, because I think during the grief process, you know, grief comes in such ginormous waves. It's yeah. like you kind of throw yourself into it. Or I at least, for me, I really try and. My motto in grieving is just to allow whatever comes to come. And it's a hard process because I think that, like, as people, we try and limit suffer. And so we're like, oh, no, we don't want to, like, oh, I don't want to, you know, that's too much pain, or we try and limit pain. But I also think it's really important to feel. So I kind of, the way I process things is always around, like, okay, if I'm feeling like I just want to, like, fall into a ball of disaster right now, I'm going to do that. If I feel like I need a break, I need to do some self-care, I'm going to do that. So, but I do agree. I think that you have to be cautious in making sure that when you're communicating with people that have crossed, that it's not in a way to hold them there. Like, please, I need you here. I need yeah. you. I need
Stay
you.
With me.
And yeah. more so, like a, I need some advice or some protection. It's more, it's less like a hold of you can't leave me.
There's yes. got to be specific. And I'm also putting this out there. So if you are someone who has lost someone really close to you, especially a spouse, a parent, a sibling,
a child,
and you don't feel like that spirit is near you, I think that's really normal.
It's really normal.
Situation is different. I know of people who their fathers came to them immediately, but it's often, I feel like it's more common for the people closest to the deceased to not feel them at all. And that's probably a reason for it.
I
don't know what it is. I'm not going to pretend to, but I have lost quite a few people over the years, and it just seems to be a pattern that the people that are kind of one or more rings away from it. At the same time, I'm also going to say, if you are one of those people that is receiving a spirit visit, be really careful before you go to the deceased and say, oh, I heard this. And I've made that mistake willingly. Like, I made the mistake with all good intention. Like, I got this message from your sister and I really wished I hadn't.
Yeah.
It's not... I can't tell you when is a good time to bring that message to someone, but err on the side of not doing it. Maybe write it down somewhere.
Yeah.
And if that conversation naturally opens up, then you could say, well, this strange thing happened to me. Let me show it to you and let me tell you. But don't come running to the deceased with messages.
Not the deceased, but the family of the deceased.
Right. Thank you. Don't go running to the family of the deceased.
Because then they might think, well, why are they coming to you, not me?
Exactly.
I was so close to them. Why wouldn't they come to me? Why would they come to you?
I mean, feelings. I think there's ways to deliver that in a way that, you know, I really get the feeling that, right, you can say it in a way that isn't like, well, this person came to me yesterday and said blah, 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 blah. You know, I think there's ways to...
I would also check in with someone else, like a third party, say, I'm having this experience.
Yeah.
What do you think it should... Do you think this is some information that this person needs to know? Because sometimes
it's not.
Sometimes it's really not. And it may... You know, and it's especially if it's very general, like, oh, they love you very much, they're at peace, okay, thank you. But sometimes there's been very specific things that I've had come up in readings where they're like, the box under the bed, you need to do something with it.
Right.
And that's a very specific message. But I would definitely check in with a third party, find out if this message is even worth relaying, and if the person you think it needs to get actually needs to get that message.
Because as well, the other thing that we need to be aware of is we don't always know the relationship between that person and the person that has passed.
Right. We may even think we know, but we might not actually know.
There might be trauma there. There might be, and we need to, like, it's not fair to bombard someone with that information. So today we have a guest, Tomas Prower, who we are really excited to have on the show. Tomas is the author of Morbid Magic, Death, Spirituality, and Culture from Around the World, which I had the pleasure of reading, and it's super, super fascinating and really, really amazing. Tomas is a graduate of the University of California, Santa Barbara, with degrees in global socioeconomics and Latin American studies. Born and raised in Southern California, his fluency in English, French, and Spanish gave him the opportunity to work for the French government as a cultural liaison throughout South America and extended assignments in Buenos Aires, Santiago de Chile, and the Amazon jungle. Since then, he has been the External Relations Director for the American Red Cross, LGBT+ Programs Director for Entertainment Productions in Los Angeles, and a licensed mortuary professional in California and Nevada. Currently, Tomas resides in his hometown of LA as a writer and author of popular fiction and nonfiction works. So I actually really loved the book. I thought that it was a really I mean, it was so in-depth, and it explained such in detail so many different cultures and the practices around death, rituals, pre-death, going into death, and post-death. And I thought it was, I don't know, I thought it was amazing. There were things that I knew. There were some cultural practices that I was aware of, and some that I had no idea existed. So it was really neat to go down that kind of wormhole into all the different practices globally. So we always start off with our guests, and we ask them first, how did you come into magic, or when did you first realize you were a witch or magical?
Oh, wow, that's a good intro, jumping right in.
We don't waste any time here.
So everybody says, like, really? I would have liked really, that in advance.
Yeah, we would like to know that. We like people to be in the moment.
Yeah.
I like that. It's more authentic that
it
way.
You know, you don't,
it gives up less time to think of lies and just...
Right, exactly. Exactly. Tell us about yourself. What would your dating profile say?
Right, yeah.
Which we want to know that as well, but...
We also want to know that, but yeah.
You could probably find that somewhere.
Ooh!
Notes are being taken down. No.
But, no, my experience into magic was very kind of accidental. The short version is that I was out and living in Reno for a while, working for the Red Cross, and I came back to Los Angeles, and I hadn't, you know, met up with my friends that I grew up here with, and one of them's kind of shady, kind of does things that you don't ask what he does, and you can remain friends that way.
Yeah. I've got a couple of those.
And, you know, I've always been interested in, like, morbid stuff. You know, when I was young, it was that golden age of darkness. You know, Silence of the Lambs was just sweeping the Oscars.
Yes.
Live-action Addams Family was happening.
Yes.
That was like, creative peak. So I kind of, like, grew up with that subconsciously. And when I came back to Los Angeles, my friend was like, hey, so I know you like all that darkness stuff. Do you want to, you know, when I'm riding around here, like, in L.A. at night, like, around, like, midnight or so, they've got these, like, you know, these churches, but it's just strip malls, and inside there's, like, all these candles, and, you know, you see these people, and there's a giant, like Grim Reaper statue. I think you'd be into that, Tomas. You want to go sometime? You know, and I'm like, of course I'd like to go.
You're like, duh.
Actually,
you
that
know
sounds
me?
Like me and Hillary back in the late, like, 90s here in Portland.
This is the 90s.
There's a Grim Reaper. Let's go see it. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's how it started. It ended up to be the La Santa Muerte group in Los Angeles that he was referring to, which, you know, I didn't know at the time. And it was just frustrating because I'm half Mexican, half Irish, but I look straight out of Dublin. You know, I have super white, super red hair. So here's, like, this super white, super redhead kid going into this, like, established Santa Muerte group. You know, everyone's scared. No one knows, like, am I ICE? Am I trying to infiltrate them? Am I trying to do something? Am I trying to find stuff out?
Yeah, it's scary.
So no one would give me any answers. And they would hand me pamphlets and things to look up on my own. And so I just had to do all the research on my own and slowly learn and slowly get into the group and show, like, no, I learn and, you know, I want to learn this. And then it just grew from there. I developed a relationship with La Santa Muerte. And then that got me into more stuff and other books and other things until, you know, here we are now. So it's been a road, but it's been a good road. But it all started with that. My friend introduced me in downtown LA.
So tell me a little bit about what inspired you specifically. I mean, we know a little bit about your background, but what inspired you to write this book? Where did this concept come up, and what was kind of the impetus for wanting to start the book and put it in book form?
I needed a follow up book to the previous book, which is Queer Magic, which is the same. Yeah, it's the same format. It's the same kind of, like, around the world in 80 days, you know, meets, like, a tour guide kind of a thing. But it was all exploring the LGBT culture and magic and spirituality from around the world. And that did really well, and I really enjoyed writing that. And so when I was reaching out for my next book, I kind of wanted to do something similar, but, like, what do you talk about? So I thought, what should I talk about? And I realized, like, something that people don't know, you know, especially from my experience working in, you know, the funeral industry, is that no one really knows about death.
So true, especially here in this culture.
Oh my God, especially. I mean, like, there's for a whole nother topic, there's so much stuff that the funeral industry gets away with that they shouldn't. There's so much shady underlying pseudo-legal things that shouldn't be happening. But nothing will ever change because no one wants to talk about death.
Oh, yeah, it's so taboo.
And these are the... Oh, my God. So we can get away with whatever we want in legislators and push what we want because no one's talking about it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of, like, stop that in a way from, like, the inside.
So, I'm curious. So what do you feel like the funeral industry is getting away with? Because that's like, talk to me. I want to know what that's about.
What do I think or what do I know?
What do you know? Tell us. Come on, Tomas. This is your chance or our chance to learn something.
Because what's really interesting is about, because it's a business and it's a sales business, essentially. So you have all these people who, let's say you want to buy a house or you want to buy a car. Usually people do their research ahead of time. They ask for opinions. They look things up online. And there's, you know, just a bunch of resources. But no, there's none of that with death because no one wants to talk about it because it makes you feel uncomfortable.
Not to mention when it's happening, you're usually in a grief state.
You mentioned that in the book too, that like you're
so you're
in
not
this...
in your right frame of mind usually when you're having to make these decisions. So you're just like, just tell me what to do and I'm going to do whatever you tell me.
Right. And you mentioned that just that, you know, people are very vulnerable in that moment. So, you know, if someone says, well, this is what you need and this is the way you should do it, you're just like, okay, I guess that's what I'm doing.
Right. So you can get easily pushed around, you know, taken for a ride, you know, sitting there in the arrangement room. But on top of that, the things you want to do that would seem common sense are not legal to do, or you don't know it's legal. Like, you can take care of the body at home. You can have a home funeral. If you want to get buried in the earth, a lot of mortuaries force you to kind of have, what's it called? It's a vault. So you can't be going naturally into the ground. You have to be in some sort of a casket, usually, you know, pumped to the nines with carcinogenic chemicals. And then inside that casket, you have to be put inside the vault, which is this cement container. And that's because the cemetery, they don't want the top of the cemetery, the grass layer, to shift because that makes it more costly to mow the lawn. So to save money, you have to buy all these extra things that you don't need, and it's illegal to not buy those things.
Yeah, it's really crazy.
Just circling back, that's why I wanted to write the book. And you even get people with kind of like, you know, quote unquote fringe beliefs
mm-hmm.
who like are uncomfortable to ask because they don't want to be judged. And, you know, you sit there in my mind, I'm like, you could have had this. You could have had your, you know, super pagan funeral. You could have had anything you wanted. But you had to prepare. You cannot do it now.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have legal stuff ready, and, you know, and you have to talk to them and tell them that. So this way, it just kind of demystifies death, shows you a lot of options, shows you what's going around with the world, but also shows you how people deal with it, you know, the living. Because everyone has to recover from grief in their own way, and maybe the way in your culture you grew up with doesn't help you in the way you need it. And there's other stuff out there. It's just people don't know.
That was one of the things I found really fascinating was the grief process in different cultures was really interesting.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The way people grieve or celebrate are like vastly different. Even now, like it's always changing in the U.S. Nowadays, it's and I don't personally like it, but I understand it. It's the whole like celebration of life versus a funeral. It's like no one wants to have a funeral anymore. Everyone wants to have a celebration of life, which is cool. I get that. I get like it's a more positive spin, but like there's something about the sadness of a funeral and going through that sadness that gets you out of grief. The celebration of life, a lot of, you know, especially with these families that keep coming back because, you know, everyone's buried in the same cemetery and they want to use the same mortuary dad did. You see that the people who have like the funerals or the sad ones, they've gotten over it faster and they're more prepared next time. The celebration of life people on average, it hits them again. Like, oh my God, there's another death. And you see them go through the whole process again. It's they're not acknowledging the death and the sadness that they have to go through to recover. And it's a weird shift here. And people are becoming less prepared of it because they don't want to feel sad. They don't want to talk about death. They don't want to acknowledge death.
That's really
it's strange, but
that
there's always
really
stuff changing happening.
I guess I always assume, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I guess I always assume because I'm someone who, like, just throws myself into grief that people that have the celebration of life do that on their own time, but I guess that maybe is not the case.
I mean, it's different for a lot of people, but the way I equate it, it's like you have this severe wound on you, you know, and you don't want to go to the doctor because then you have to acknowledge that you have this severe wound on you. So in order to not be given the diagnosis and not have to accept it and deal with it and do what you have to do, you kind of just kind of ignore it and you learn to walk a different way. You know, if it's your foot, you learn how to start using your left hand and you kind of just get on with life with not acknowledging it.
Part of it is this culture of wanting to rush to comfort. And yeah, there are some,
that's really true.
Yeah, there are some pagan elders that say that the rush to comfort is actually about the comforter as opposed to the comfortee. And this isn't a death, but when I was first in the workforce, you know, I'd left Oregon, moved to New York, and I had a job, and I got laid off a few months after that. And I went out with some of my coworkers, and at one point I just started crying and saying, I don't know what to do. And I'll never forget the woman I was talking to just sat there, and it was obvious that she knew I was crying, but she didn't change her body posture. She didn't go, oh, honey. She didn't hold my hand. She didn't try to hug me. She just sat with me completely present while I cried. And I remember thinking, this actually feels really good. She's witnessing my process. But she's not trying to stop it. Because when someone's trying to comfort you, you feel like you've got to return that comfort, which is...
Right, like suddenly like, oh, I have to start feeling better because otherwise you're going to feel bad that you're not comforting
and
me.
It's also different than when you see somebody's body posture change and they need a hole. And Hillary, I'm sorry to put you on the spotlight here, but know that when your mom was in the process of transition, at one point you just curled over and was in tears and I held you.
But you still let me... Right. Yeah. You didn't stop. You were like, oh, it's going to be fine. Take some drink. You're going to be all right. Everything's going to be okay.
It's like, but it's also a point of this woman needs a human touch right now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that touch can be supportive, but I think I agree that we have this instinct, I think, to say, oh, don't worry. Everything's going to be fine. It'll just be fine. And you're like, well, it sure doesn't fucking feel like it's going to be fine right now. So just let me feel, you know? Yeah. So it's like, I think we do. I think that's really true. We have a want to comfort. And I think it comes out of a good place of wanting to help, but sometimes I think it can impede the process. I have another question for you. So when you started going through this process, is there anything that you found that kind of holds true across cultures? Is there anything? I know there's vast differences and there are some surprising similarities that I noticed, but is there any one thing or couple things that you feel are true regardless of practice?
I think one of the biggest things is something that we just touched on together. It's the fact that grief and the pain of grief is normal. And everyone's, the way they deal with funerals, the way they deal and interact with the afterlife, it's a way to not kind of mask that grief or rush it past so you can get on with life. It's really just facing grief and dealing with it and getting over it in your own time. And it's really interesting. It's the whole modern phenomenon of, you know, like you just said, just rush, make you feel better. Oh, I feel uncomfortable because you're uncomfortable about this. Here, hug, don't be sad anymore. That's not happening. There's not a lot of comfort. It's a lot of really painful, you know, processes you have to get through. And a lot of these different rituals around the world are meant to look at the pain and deal with it. And if it's fast, it's that rip the Band-Aid off really fast, like it's going to hurt. But there's never an avoidance of the pain. It's just a way to soldier on through it till you get to the other side. That was really interesting.
That is really interesting. I mean, I definitely noticed that. I mean, obviously there were different approaches to the way that grief was done on a spiritual or cultural or level. But every single one had like a process, a thing. So that's really, that must have been interesting to find.
It was, and the other thing to really keep in mind is that back then, even like 100 years ago, death was more common. People are really scared of death now because, you know, I live in Los Angeles and I didn't realize it until I got into the mortuary business here, but you know, we have millions upon millions upon millions of people living here and, you know, lots of them are dying every day. But I had never seen a dead body. So many people living around me, so many deaths happening, never seen a dead body outside of, you know, the stage makeup painted casket at a funeral. Death is hidden away from us. It's in the basements of the hospitals. It's, you know, traveling in unmarked vans on the city streets. It's everywhere, but the whole society is to hide it from you. And because you can't see it, no one talks about it. It's like this boogeyman in our culture. No one, don't talk about it. It's this mysterious entity. So your imagination just goes wild. But in all these older cultures, you know, they saw grandma die.
They watched it happen. I know. It's very strange. I've obviously, Courtney mentioned lost my mom, and we were very present for that whole process. But I have friends who were like, you were there? And I was like, what the hell are you talking? Yeah. We sat there for hours, like an hour or two afterwards, as we waited for the funeral home to come, and we washed her body, and we put her in a dress, like we dressed her, and it was like part of it was not easy, but it was like part of that ritual for close people that were there. And so it was a really interesting thing to see people who are like, oh no, we left the room, we couldn't be in there, or like, we didn't get a chance to see. And then, yeah, I've been to open casket funerals as well. And I was like, this is very odd. Like, I'm like, this is, I mean, not that it was bad. I mean, I completely understand, like, maybe that was the chance for people to see that person, and that's the memory they wanted to hold. And I mean, I totally understand where that is coming from, and people have to choose what is right, feels right for them. But for me, it felt really foreign. I was like, well, what? And I mean, maybe that's because I come from a family of like doctors and scientists. So like that is, you know, it's never been death, illness, you know, none of that has been taboo.
Well, and this, you know, and if there's a crime, right, what's the first thing they do? They don't leave a dead body lying there so that people can see it. They cover it. I mean, as soon as they possibly can, they cover it. So no one actually sees this. And so I think you're right. And it's interesting to me that, you know, I'm more similar to Hillary in that, you know, to me, I've always been raised with, you know, death is a part of life. It's there. There's no point not thinking about it. It's like literally the only guarantee. Like, exactly. You're going to die. People are going to die. It's what's going to happen. But there's a lot of people who just, they just don't even go there. It's just completely not thought about. And myself included, as far as I've had very little people I know pass away. So my life has been impacted relatively minorly from people passing away. I have not lost anyone super significant to me, minus my grandfather when I was 16.
And Nick.
And that was probably the most traumatic.
Yeah.
That was probably the most traumatic when we were 18. But, you know, I mean, in general, I mean, I'm almost 40 now. So, I mean, when you can name, you know, fewer people on one hand, like, I feel pretty blessed. It's not, there are other people where, I mean, they have far more traumatic experiences, and they have lots of them. So I think it's not something I've ever thought about, but it's true. We, not only do we as people naturally not usually come across death, or may not, just in our comings and goings, but society is actually keeping it from us to an even more extent. True. What made you want to get into, I mean, I think we all naturally probably have some sort of a interest in death and whatnot, but what specifically made you want to get into mortuary work?
I needed to pay the bills, and I needed to pay the bills quickly.
That'll do it. That's why I got involved as a secretary.
The funeral industry, it's changing, thank God, but it's very much an old boys club.
Yeah, I can see
that. It's a very, you know, old men secret, old conservative men secret society, kind of let's not share information and let's purposely use disinformation to gain more money in that way. And it's like,
But that's what's funny, because from what I understand, and you likely cover this in your book, is that this used to be women's work, is taking care of the dead. Like in my research on Hecate, it was the women who would tend the graves and tend the dead bodies. So in doing magic with the dead, which is a lot of what Hecate is about, it was almost always a woman doing it, because it would be normal for a woman to be in the graveyard tending the graves. But I read, and Tomas, you tell me if this is mistaken, that it was during the Civil War in the United States that it became men's work, because there were so many soldiers who needed to be essentially embalmed and sent home. And so men realized this was a way to make money, and they took the work from the women.
I mean, that's exactly right. When it's a domestic thing and it's free labor, then you have the women do it, you know, business-wise.
Watching our heads all explode.
Every single one of us is like, why? No,
it's unfortunate because, like you said, back in the day, a lot of cultures, women dealt with it. And whether that's because, you know, for their own cultural reasons, you know, from the womb to tomb kind of thing, you know, a woman brings you in and she'll help bring you out. Women are more in touch with the other side and spirituality. Or even, you know, some cultures it was just because, you know, dead bodies are gross and putrid and disgusting, so that's women's work.
Or it's also...
For whatever reason.
Yeah, the person who's sick is at home. And the woman is at home, taking care of the home and the children and the elderly and taking care of the sick. And so...
And hence the dying.
And hence the dying. And probably the woman who's pregnant is close to home because she can't be out hunting the way the men are, or fighting or what have you. Not it. The way in every culture... You know, before people get upset, that's just kind of tends to be a generality. And so it tends to make sense. Okay, this person, so grandma's been ill for months. And so she's been at home with mom taking care of her. She passes away. So yeah, mom's going to take care of her as she has been.
What was the thing that what did you find most surprising? When you started doing all this research on different cultures, when you started looking into different like death rites, rituals, processes, spiritual practices, what was most surprising to you?
Oh, God.
Or a surprising thing. I feel like that's putting you on the spot. What was one of the more surprising things?
One of the big surprising things that I had to check, because when I found out about it, I'm like, this can't be true. I'm reading some, like, you know, quote-unquote fake news site that's not happening, that's just there for sensationalist clickbait. I'm like, this can't be true. But then you look further and it's like, oh my God, yeah, this is true. And then it's so sensational that, you know, you take a step back from yourself thinking, what, you know, why did I think that was so sensational when it's an everyday practice to these people? Like, it's not sensational to them. And one of the biggest thing that I found of that nature was like funeral strippers. It's the professional industry of, you know, erotic dancers at a funeral.
What?
And how that is just normal.
Where is that? What part of the world does that tend to happen?
It's a lot of East Asia, but mostly rural China, and especially in Taiwan. I mean, because they have, you know, it goes more into the book, but they're kind of like the Confucian belief of familial piety, you know, and honor. And in death, it's seen like the more people that show up to a funeral, it's like, that was a great man. You have all of the village coming to visit this man. Oh, he was great. You know, if you have just two people come to dad's funeral, it's like, oh, well, dad was a nobody. Therefore, he gets no honor now. So a kind of modern way to kind of get a lot of people at mom or dad's funeral is, you know, the atom of sex sells. And it does. Sex is a big business.
I mean, sex and death,
a lot of things. But people realize that, well, as long as they're coming, that's where the honor lies. So people will have, you know, strippers at a funeral, but it's not, you know, like day shift strippers. It's full-on professional, highly paid.
Tomas and I are best friends now, by the way. We're best casket.
He's like, this is not the brunch crowd. This is the midnight girl.
Unless you're at the brunch we were just at, so yeah.
Hey, those queens are cool.
It's the A-team. It's definitely the A-team.
Yes.
It's, you know, fog machines, lasers, whatever you can get. And obviously the family knows that everyone's there to see the girls. But it doesn't matter because the point is you got a lot of people to mom's funeral. Therefore, all these people showed up and in the eyes of the universe, you fulfilled your familial piety and you gave mom the greatest honor by having the biggest funeral in the village. And, it, you know, that stems from, because it seems like, what? That sounds like a modern thing. It kind of is. But it goes back to the ancient, you know, Eastern Asian of wailing women. And there's a lot of wailing women in a lot of cultures, but it's to pay these professional mourners to make this gigantic, you know, hyperbolic, over-emotional statement, crying, wailing. They're getting paid for this, so it's all kind of forced. But it's to show that, oh my God, look how dad affected these women. Now that he's not here, they can't go on with life. They're just these balls of horrid emotions and they can't control themselves. He must have had so much honor. So from paying women to, you know, being over emotional at a funeral to paying them to dance, it's a very 21st century solution to, you know, ancient problems. And I found that fascinating. And that I found it fascinating that I found it fascinating because obviously these people don't find it fascinating. It's just, oh, you know, there's another funeral in town. It's like, there's another show.
Is there, in your travels and stuff before you went into... before you went into the business, is there one particular culture or one particular maybe ritual that you really felt was, I don't want to say worked, but you know what I mean, that really seemed to help people or that really seemed to...
Or that you were drawn
or,
to?
Yeah, that you were particular? Drawn to, that you were just like, wow, that I like that. That's awesome.
during my travels, what I really liked that kind of, you know, quote-unquote worked was... being present with the dead body as a dead body, not as this, you know, thing with stage makeup and stage lighting that we do. But it's actually dealing with death. And it could be as simple as helping to wash the body, helping to dress, you know, the body, just doing something physical to contribute right there in the presence of a dead body. Because even going to a funeral nowadays and you go up to a casket, it's this whole... grand illusion to make someone seem like they're sleeping so you don't have to deal with death again. Yeah. So just by seeing someone dead, I've seen a lot of people really get through the grief because they have to acknowledge it. When you're there dressing, you know, rigor mortis mom, you know she's dead. Right. You know that she's not there
it's
anymore.
Not faith. Yeah,
and it really helps you get through that. A lot of people that I've seen.
I totally agree with
that. When I was a little girl, the first dead body I saw was my grandfather, and it was at his funeral. And you know, he had been whatever they, you know, presented and stuff like that. And my cousin and I were going up and touching his face. And we were like, he feels so cold. And my parents were like, stop.
They were like, oh my God, no. Your parents have been mortified.
They were like, don't do that. And we're like, but we were just curious. You know, I was 7, I think. Yeah. And so it makes sense that a 7-year-old is like, and I remember my little sister who was 5 says, she goes, I keep thinking I see him breathing. You know, and it's because he looked so lifelike.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that, I think it was many, many years later that I realized one day that he wasn't just going to wake up. But I kind of remember the moment. I was upstairs in my grandmother's house. And in my head, you know, I'd been raised Christian. So I said, yeah, we'll see him in heaven. And this woman, I'm like, yes, but I will never see him while I'm still alive. And that moment that sat with me like, oh, okay. And it took many years later. And I think that part of it was how it was presented to me as a child. You know, parents wanting to spare their kids, saying, oh, well, he went to heaven and that sort of thing. And then also, don't touch the body. And he looks just like he always did. Looks like he was taking
don't
a nap on the couch.
Don't touch
the body.
I love it.
Yeah, but I remember that. My cousin was like, his cheeks feel like cold chicken patties. And I'm like touching his face.
Oh my God.
But that's what a kid would do, you
that's
know?
Like it, well, I think we don't have...
Kids don't understand
don't have
it's
that,
taboo.
They don't have that, yeah, they don't have that acknowledgement, like, so, like cultural idea that this is like... bad or wrong,
but,
you're just like, oh, it's a dead person.
But I think it's that, I think it was that, I still remember what it felt like. I think it was that as a kid, that was the one way I could understand that something is different here.
Yeah.
Because he looked like he was sleeping on the couch. But when I touched him, he was really cold.
Not sleeping
that
on
was
the couch,
not
yeah.
what a human's supposed to feel like,
yeah.
you know?
Well, and it's funny as we're touching on this, like, with children and the dead. It's funny because you actually think about, like, I guess I've never really thought about how much as a society we shield ourselves from death. Like, that society in general is shielding you from it. There are things that are happening that keep you from witnessing or seeing this. And one of the things that parents often do is you switch up your kids' fish before they find out it's dead. You know, little things like that, right?
Wait a minute. Did Charlie always have a black spot? Yes.
Fluffy didn't die. He's living in a farm right now, chasing sheep somewhere. You know, like, parents even do that to children.
Yeah.
Like, instead of just saying, oh, I'm sorry, your pet died. We're not going to have your pet anymore. They can sometimes, you know, just completely gloss over it and change the pet or fib and, you know, say, no, they're living on a farm. We just couldn't have them anymore. But, I mean, it starts really young. That people are shielded from the concept of death
here.
In
this culture, for sure. Before we run out of time, we have this thing that we do at the end of each episode. It's so below as above. We're always like, wait, is it this?
Someone literally
just trolled us about that on Instagram not that long ago. She was like, they always get it wrong. I was like, oh my God. So we say so below as above instead of as above so below, because what we do is something that we would like to get rid of, something we're releasing, and something that we are calling in. Or asking for. We would love to have you participate. We ask our guests
Let's go first and give Tomas a minute to think about it. So I'll go first. So I gave up something kind of big this week. Is I gave up working on the phone psychic hotline.
Whoa.
Yes, I did. I resigned from the phone psychic hotline. I was in the middle of a reading and it just clicked to me that I don't want to do this right now. I'm still taking phone clients for my tarot business, but I was working moonlighting as Clementine, the phone psychic, with this hotline. And it was very hard work, very little pay, and some of the things I was dealing with were way above my maturity level, so to speak, like how to counsel someone whose daughter's on heroin, or the person who is clearly having a schizophrenic episode and is not possessed by demons. These are things that I was doing my best, but clearly was not equipped to handle. And I'm not opposed to doing it again, but I realized right now I'm really focused a lot on time as we think about death. And as you know, I'm 38 and thinking about what, you know, time to me is far more precious than a few extra dollars. And so the 5 to 8 hours per week I was working on the psychic hotline, I would like to use to see my regular clients or work on my book. So I'm giving that up, of giving up wasted time or time that is not well spent. I don't want to call it a waste because I feel like I did help some people, but I'm going to give that up and I'm going to bring in better focus time so I can go deeper into the book that I'm working on in Hecate. Speaking of deities of death, that's one. That's me.
I am hopefully wanting to bring in some success and some financial security. I have been going through with a fine tooth comb all of our expenses and what do we not need to do? What do we need to do? We would really, really like to buy a house. We have a condo right now. We'd really like to have a house.
House next door to me is for sale.
Absolutely not. With a yard and all that kind of good stuff. Far, far away from Courtney. And so I am just trying to be a very good girl and be very diligent about what our expenses are and things like that, and starting to kind of focus more on what we want for the future. And not, I feel like our day-to-day has slowed down enough that now I can actually stop, take a breath, and think about what we want. And I am frankly trying to let go of the guilt that it has taken me this long to get to this place where I feel like we've just been kind of going by the seat of our pants for so long and just kind of doing what we wanted and not really having a plan and just kind of going through life. And so now I have a lot of guilt. Like, why didn't you start doing this 5 years ago? You know, why haven't you always been on top of this? So I'm trying to not be kicking myself about that and just feel good about the fact that I'm focused on it now.
Yeah.
And wanting to make a plan and trying to make the plan happen.
So for me, sometimes you ask for things and you forget to ask for them in moderation. So previously I was like, I want more artistic opportunities. And now I'm like buried in them, which is great. A great problem to have. But I also am like at my max of, between work and the podcast and teaching voice and singing and working with other artists and performing, it's like a lot. So I am letting go of opportunities that don't serve me. So taking opportunities that are not even that exciting. Sometimes I'm like, oh yeah, I'll do that, because I was really like, this is great. I'm like, bringing in a lot of more creative energy because I felt it had dropped for a while. So now I'm like, okay, now I have so much of it. I'm back in a good place of wanting to choose opportunities that serve me well and that are either lucrative or incredibly impactful for me. So like either it's something I'm incredibly passionate about or something that's incredibly lucrative. So I'm letting go of opportunities that don't serve me and continuing to bring in opportunities that do. Tomas? Your turn.
I think one thing that I really thought this morning that's would be good to, I guess, like, give up and change about it would be to be less critical of myself in the mirror.
Aww.
Not that I have a self-image issue. If anything, I'm too full of myself. But the thing is that, you know, I've noticed this morning that every time I look in the mirror, it's always to, like, criticize. It's always, you know, I gotta brush my teeth. You know, I gotta fix this with my teeth. I gotta fix my hair. I gotta change this. Do I have something on my face? Even when I'm not, you know, it's not a morning thing. Every time I look in the mirror, I've noticed it's to inspect myself to change something or to fix something or to make something better. You know, whether it's getting ready for the day or just, you know, you're out using a restroom somewhere and you check to make sure you look presentable and there's nothing wrong with you. I'm always looking for what's wrong so I can fix it whenever I look in a mirror. And I realize I should probably stop doing that. I should probably just look and enjoy. And, you know, if anything seems off, don't have that be the focus of why I'm purposely looking in a mirror. Just, oh, I noticed that. Perfect. If I didn't, oh, well. Someone else will probably let me know.
That's a good one. I think I do that sometimes where I'm like, rather than just being like, I look nice, I'm like, what's that hair out of place? What's that thing on my, you know, like.
Yeah, just always thinking, and that's.
My makeup is smeared.
Capitalism at play, trying to get us to buy things.
Yeah, it works.
Yeah. Is there something you'd want to bring in?
Something to bring in, God. I don't know, like, probably, you know, could have my mind on this more of a magic book right now. I guess it's just more book contracts to be able to keep doing this, you know, make it viable.
I would like you
so
to
I,
keep
I would like more of that, books. More different subjects to write about, more things, just, you know, the opportunity to keep on keeping on.
What's your favorite, just out of curiosity, what is the favorite thing when you wrote this book that, like, you learned or you came across, that you came across specifically because you wrote this book?
Oh, God. The biggest thing was something that really resonated with something that I felt strongly about, but was pseudo-controversial, and I found kind of justification in the Maori culture of it. And I was like, yes, see? It's not just me thinking about this. It's an actual thing in cultures around the world. And I always had a problem with death, and how whenever someone would die, they'd be kind of beatified, or suddenly all their sins would be washed away. Yes. So you'd have this, you know, this awful man who would, like, you know, beat his children and just be super, you know, racist, homophobic, misogynistic, and then he died, and suddenly all these people are like, oh, he was the greatest man that ever lived. Yeah. He was so kind, he was so sensitive, he was so this adjective. And I always had a problem with that. I'm like, no, if someone was bad in life, they don't suddenly become amazing. And I always had a problem at every funeral I went to. I'm just like, that wasn't this person. Who is this? Who's this talking? Did you know him? Did you know her? You know, and in Maori culture, they have this big thing where they kind of, you know, like the Festivus thing from Seinfeld, where you air all your grievances.
Oh,
you know, someone's dead.
Wow.
And right there in the funeral, you don't eulogize to, like, build someone up after they've died. It's like, I've had a problem with this person. He's always been a thief, and he's always been, you know, mean to my children. You know, he used to beat me when I was a child. And you know what? I don't think it's bad that he's dead. And it's allowing you, the living, to get that off your chest and not bury that in the ground with the dead and, like, yes. Live with that lie. It's letting everyone and just releasing it. And I always thought, yes, exactly. I mean, death doesn't, you know, it's not, you know, the water from Lourdes. It's not going to wash away all your sins. It's, you don't get a free pass because you died.
That's always been something that fascinates me as well. Because, like, my mom will be the first person, like, someone will die, and she'll be like, he was an asshole. She's like, who cares? Like, she'll say it. Like, she doesn't.
What Betty Davis said, I'm only supposed to speak good of the dead. Joan Crawford is dead. Good. But that actually happened. Hillary, remember when there was a woman who taught us in high school who passed away? And I wrote to you and I said, I'm having feelings because this was a really difficult person.
It was a very difficult person. And I said, Courtney had said, like, you know, I have really mixed emotions. And I was like, it's okay to understand, it's okay to realize that it's sad that a young person lost their life young and
yes.
still recognize that that person wasn't always
that really
the greatest
made our lives really difficult.
Yeah.
And that was, it's like, okay, thank you for nailing it, saying, yeah, I am sad this person died ahead of, you know, before.
Yeah, I mean,
before then, you know, in her 50s, which is, you know, pretty young.
Maybe even younger than that. And it was like, this person died young, and, you know, I mean, it's like, it's, and I think it's okay to, I mean, the thing is I actually think it's okay to be sad and angry. I think it's okay to say, you know, I'm sad for this loss, but that doesn't take away the anger that I have over certain things that had happened. Yeah. I don't think those things are mutually exclusive.
Right.
Did you find in your studies, like, why people do that? Like, why that became a thing where people suddenly, it's like, they're forgiven for, you know, all the atrocities maybe that they had?
A lot of it kind of has to do with fear of the dead. Because if you have all these people coming back to haunt you, you know, don't speak ill of the dead. Because they, now that someone's dead, they have all these magical supernatural powers with which they can come back at you. Okay. So once someone's dead, you don't say anything bad because, you know, that lightning bolt could hit you, or a flood could happen, or the earthquake could happen, or you'll get sick. You know, it's they are more powerful now. And so you always have to be careful talking about the dead and saying anything bad about them. So everything kind of becomes, you know, overblown to the point of falseness of, oh, yes, you know, the most wonderful person ever lived, so kind, best husband, best father, family man, community man. So that the spirit on the other side is like, yes, you know, and you inflate their ego so they don't harm you.
Okay. So that's where that comes from.
But some cultures don't have that. And it's just, it was refreshing.
Yeah, I like those cultures.
I
like the, you know, the other thing too is I think, like, I said this the other day. I was like, you know, you can be compassionate for, even if you really hate someone, even if you're like, oh, I'm celebrating, like, this person was awful and I don't care that they're dead. Like, let's throw a party. The thing is like, it's okay to also recognize, to feel compassion for the people that do grieve that loss. Yes. And like be considerate to them, you know, like, and I think part of the bashing, I mean, like, it's like, I think it's okay to have both of them. Again, I don't think the sadness and the anger have to be mutually exclusive. I think you can be like, this person was terrible to me and like, I'm fucking mad about it. And I think it's also okay to say, well, like, I'm sorry for this family that's grieving that loss. I think it's okay to have both of those. Anyway.
It is. I mean, grief is different from one. So it's how you process it. No one talks about how to get through grief, so no one knows.
That's very true. Well, Tomas, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. And we really, really thank you for making time for us. For those of you that haven't checked out Tomas's book, make sure to go pick it up. Morbid Magic, Death Spirituality, and Culture from Around the World. Thank you again, Tomas. We really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you.
See everybody in 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Join us on the first and third Mondays of the month for magical tools, tips, and stories about living as a witch in today's world.
Find us at thatwitchlife.com for archived episodes or to ask your burning questions for us to answer in a future